I'm Sarika Mehta, sitting in for Dime Roberts, and this is Stage and Studio. Asif Manvi is an actor, writer, and producer based out of New York. He is the senior Muslim correspondent on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. He was born in Mumbai, India, spent his childhood in England, and his adolescence in Tampa, Florida. Navigating this hodgepodge of hometowns is the basis of his book, No Land's Man, which is on sale now. Asif Manvi is our guest today, and he joins me by phone. Asif, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
So the book is called No Land's Man. What motivated you to write this book?
Well, you know, I was, I had always been writing. I've been writing, I wrote a one-man show several years ago, and so there were always sort of stories and essays and monologues that I've always been writing, sort of inspired by things that happened to me in my life. And then I was approached by Chronicle Books they asked me if I'd like be interested in writing a book, and I'd never thought about writing a book before. I'd written stuff for the stage, and I'd written film and stuff like that, but never really taken on this challenge of writing a book of essays. So I thought it'd be great. I thought it'd be fun, and I got to express something in a way that I hadn't done before. And so the book very much felt like an extension for me of stuff that I've been doing on The Daily Show for many years, a sort of critique of American, or really commentary on American life as an insider and an outsider at the same time, but now using my own life as a template for that, and using stories from my own life to continue that commentary.
I imagine it was a challenge, you know, to write something like this, which is different but similar to writing for this, as you mentioned, for the stage and for the Daily Show.
Writing in sort of prose form is very different than writing dialogue or, you know, something that is to be performed. There was a little bit of I had to get my head around that. But, you know, it's funny, my editor said to me, she goes, in most cases, I always tell my writers to read their work out loud in order to see if it works, you know, their stories. And in your case, she's like, I'm encouraging you not to read it out loud. Because that is kind of the way I write anyway. So it was definitely a new arena for me.
Sure. And there are a number of fascinating stories and vignettes. It was a really fun read, which I want to get to in a moment. I first wanted to ask you, what brought your family to Tampa from England?
Well, a number of things brought my family to Tampa. It was the 80s, it was Thatcher, the economy. My father always wanted to move to either the United States or Canada. But then he came out to America, or to Florida, on a reconnaissance mission to see if he wanted to move to Florida and move his family here. And I guess somebody took him out for brunch. And I write this story in the book about how my father ate brunch and fell in love with this idea of an American brunch, and he thought, I think, that it was a third meal. Like, he called us back in England on the phone, and he said, in America there is so much food that between breakfast and lunch they have a third meal. It is called brunch, and he really thought it was like a third meal in the middle of the day that was, all you could eat for $7.95. And so I think he fell in love with this idea and was like, we're all moving to America because this is the greatest land in the world.
He was sold on brunch, the $7.99 brunch.
Yeah, and it used to be $7.99.
Well, right, of course, a little bit different now.
I think that was, again, I write in the book that my father sort of embraced America's consumer culture with open arms and an even wider mouth, you know.
Well, turning to your book specifically, something I found really interesting, you're talking about your schooling as a child in Britain and your schooling as a teenager in Florida. And mm-hmm. well, before I get into that, one really adorable story that I enjoyed was the American approximation of these names. Like, you had another Indian classmate named Dilip, and the approximation of your name, Asif, and those of us who also have Indian names, who've grown up in this country with American approximations. Can you tell us about that story?
When I first got to Tampa, to high school, It was very interesting to me. I'd never heard the Americanization of Indian names, and so there's a guy named Dilip, and people would just call him Dilip, you know, and this kind of thing would go on all the time. Like Akbar would become Akbar, you know, or Namita would become Namira or Namira, you know, mm-hmm. and these sort of Americanizations, and it was very interesting to me, and that is part of a larger story I talk about in terms of my initial experiences of high school culture in Tampa, Florida, having come from like the north of England in an industrial coal mining town where I grew up, and then coming to this American high school where, you know, and I was really excited about it. I sort of got here and I was like, oh, you know, this is going to be amazing. I thought, like, you know, I'd grown up on American pop culture, so I thought it was going to be like, you know, my girlfriend was going to be Miss Teen USA and I would be best friends with a dolphin or something, you know, and that would be my life in Florida. That's what I figured everybody in Florida did, just surfed and hung out on the beach, and, you know, and then I ended up in Tampa, and it was a suburban lifestyle essentially that we had, and there weren't a lot of Indians. There was one Indian restaurant in Tampa when I got there, and I came from a town which had a huge South Asian and specifically Pakistani population, and then I got to a city in America where there was one Indian restaurant, and people mostly thought I was Mexican for like the first year that I was in school, you know.
Right. Well, something that was interesting that you said, that you found Britain to be rather distrustful of foreigners, whereas Americans seemed more accepting. I found that as a really interesting perspective. Tell us why you felt that way.
Well, you know, there's two sides to that. Like, so in Britain, I always felt like as a foreigner, especially as an Indian immigrant, because of the long history, I think, that between India and Britain, you know, there was always a sense of like, you were not British. Like, you were, you know, it doesn't matter how long you live here, like how long, you know, there was a kind of a mistrust of foreigners in general in the UK, but I think specifically towards Indians, it's always been that sense of like, you're not going to be British. And then in America, I got here, and there was a sense of like, oh yeah, sure, America's the land of immigrants, and everybody just pledges allegiance to the flag and becomes American, you know. But on the flip side of that, there was a tremendous lack of curiosity about other cultures, and I think that is what was surprising to me about America when I first got here, which was that most Americans sort of assume that everybody in the world would just be an American if they had the choice. And I say in the book that Americans think about the rest of the world the way New Yorkers think about the rest of America, which is they don't. You know? and that was my feeling. Like it was sort of almost like, oh, you're Indian? Yeah, we don't really know much about that or where that is, or India is somewhere in the Middle East, right? And forget all that, the history, the culture, all that you come from. Like, now you're an American and you'll eat hamburgers and just sort of buy into the Americana, which is great, but I think it leaves you a little disconnected from yourself, you know, as an immigrant.
Of course. In fact, there's also a part in the book, you say that the world is a much easier, friendlier place if white people like you. So tell us why that was true before and in Tampa and maybe even now.
Well, that's a line in the book where I'm talking about when I was a kid in England, and my cousin Munir came to visit us from Bahrain, where he lived with his family. And there was this sort of, I kind of resented him on some level, and I was, you know, we were both 11 years old, but I remember resenting him, and part of the reason I resented him, I think, was because he seemed to have this self-confidence that I didn't have, and I think part of it came from the fact that he lived in a world where everyone looked like him. He never thought about himself as being an outsider or a foreigner or having to like fit in or something like that, and my life as an immigrant kid, as a brown kid, even in England growing up in school, even though there were a lot of other brown people and Indians in the city that I grew up in, there was always that sense of like, if you can make friends with the popular culture, with the predominant culture, then you're doing better. And that exists even today, I think. You know, like if white people like you, then you're going to get further. You're going to get ahead. You know, as opposed to because they sort of dictate what the culture is. You know, so you want to buy into that. You know, and you know, Indian parents will probably tell you that, you know, like, rather my daughter, if she's not going to marry an Indian guy, I'd rather she marry a white guy than a black guy, because the fact is that white people at least have the keys to the kingdom, you know?
Right, right. We've all heard those tropes, honestly, to growing up. Another really heartbreaking but funny story from your book is the story of your father losing his job as a customer service representative. So without using actual profanity, tell us this story. Remember.
Well, it's hard to do without using actual profanity.
We have some FCC
regulations. But no, my dad was not very good at swearing in English, and he would get all the words mixed up, and it was hilarious to me and my sister. And I tell this story about how, you know, this actually happened at one point in my dad's life, where he was a Verizon customer service rep after the age of 60, when he had essentially retired and was doing this part time, and he had this belligerent customer and swore at him because the guy was you know, saying racial epithets to him and you know, calling him the N-word and things like that on the phone. So he swore and got fired, and this was kind of a thing that happened in our family and to my dad, and I wanted to write a story about what that conversation would be and why two people would come to that place. And really that story for me, on a larger level, is really about the miscommunication between East and West, this idea of like two people who really are coming from very different positions and just miss, and because of the, you know, the civility and sort of human just connection goes out the window, and what happens is that they both come at it with very specific agendas and end up in this place. Because my father also could have in that moment transferred that call to somebody else, which would have been the protocol, but instead he chose to engage with this guy because of his own relationship to being on the other end of abusive comments like that. And he wanted to engage, he wanted to fight, and the lack of and the fact that they were both on the phone, they didn't have to look at each other in the face, allowed them to be more vicious and cruel to each other than they might have been otherwise. And that, I feel like, is something, is my way of sort of talking about East and West and what is happening in the world today with the Muslim world vis-a-vis the Western world, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really great story. And I mean, the comments your dad had to endure were horrifying. And I mean, I think any outsider would have looked at that and said, your dad was in the right to swear back at him,
sure,
even though
yeah.
the protocol dictates to transfer out that call. It was just a way he was trying to take back the power, I think.
Yeah, and that's what I think it is that humiliation often leads to, you know, that kind of action, and that's what my father experienced in that moment, where like years of constant humiliation then led to this explosion that he had, which is, and then he was fired, right? So that is the trajectory of what happens in, often, you know, in the Muslim world, or the Middle East, rather, vis-a-vis the way the West views it, which is that, oh, there's an explosion, there's an anger, a rage, but that comes from years and years of humiliation, which then results in that, and then that place itself pays the price for that, you know what I mean? So in that, it's sort of a microcosm of that. Like, my dad paid the price for swearing, which was inappropriate, but yet that came from years and years of humiliation, of being called these names by various people where he had kept his mouth shut for many, many years, you know?
Exactly. You're listening to Stage and Studio. I'm guest host Sarika Mehta, sitting in for Dime Roberts. If you missed any of this show, you can hear it again on stageandstudio.org. My guest today is Asif Mandi, New York-based actor, writer, and producer. He's the author of No Land's Man, which explores his many identities as an Indian, British, Muslim, American actor. So we were just talking about some stories from your childhood and your adolescence and about your family. I wanted to talk more about your career as an actor, writer, and producer. There are some really, again, incredible stories about your auditions and breaking into this very, very tough market. One of your first auditions in New York was for That of a Snake Charmer.
Yeah.
First, tell us that story and how that led to the concept of patenking.
So there's a story in the book called Patenking, and it is basically the sound that a Indian accent makes, or rather the way a Westerner hears an Indian accent, right? So it's like patank, 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 you know? And that is kind of what Indian actors or South Asian actors are asked to do often when they go to these auditions. At least when I first started out in the business and was in New York, and one of my first auditions was I went to audition for the role of a snake charmer. And I remember they said to me, hey, you know, that they asked me, and this is completely earnestly, they were like, do you actually know how to snake charm? And I, you know, was so desperate for the job because I was, you know, an out-of-work actor, that I remember saying to them, I don't know how to snake charm, but I am Indian, so it could be in my DNA, you know?
and did they realize you were being sarcastic?
What's that?
Did they realize you were being sarcastic?
The thing is, like, I don't know how sarcastic I was actually being. I think I actually really wanted the job, so I was like, in that moment, I was like, I could learn, you know what I mean? I might have a leg up from any other white actor that, you know, just because it's something, you know, whatever. And so I think the whole thing was uncomfortable, and it was, and it's only in retrospect now that I can look back on it and go like, oh yeah, that was insane, that was crazy, you know. But at the time, it was just sort of the par for the course, like you know. And actually, my friend Sakina Jaffrey, who is a terrific actress who people know now from House of Cards, she coined the phrase patanking, which is basically that sound, and we would always talk about that after we came back from auditions, and we would say, you know, did they make you patank? Did you have to patank? And it always meant, inevitably, when they did ask you to patank, you knew that you were going to be patanking when you did that role, you know? So that was the sort of, you know, until I wrote Sakina's Restaurant, and that was my response in some ways, was writing my own one-man show, and I wrote this one-man show called Sakina's Restaurant, which we ended up doing off-Broadway at the American Place Theater, and that was my way of kind of taking back those roles and trying to write roles that were more nuanced and complex than the roles I was getting asked to audition for, you know, most of the time. The interesting thing about that, though, was when I first started going in for these roles where they would ask me to do the Indian accent, I realized that I didn't know how to do the Indian accent. And it was something about the fact that I had suppressed it in myself, that, you know, having grown up in the West and in the UK and America, like the Indian accent was sort of the accent of my father. And I didn't want to do that. And on some psychological level, I had forgotten how to do it or never really done it. And so it wasn't until I got asked to do it as an actor in New York for auditions that I had to sort of almost relearn how to do the Indian accent. It was something that, like, I had to sort of find a place in me that was open enough and willing enough to go there to do it, because it was a symbolic, a literal suppression, which was symbolic of something larger, I think.
It's such a bizarre experience to be, I imagine, you know, as a South Asian American actor who is told, can you be more Indian, so to speak, in the superficial, you know, lens of their eyes. In fact, isn't there a story about your role in the film, The Internship, and involving a dialect coach to teach you to be
So when I got Indian. The role in The Internship, which is the movie that came out in 2012 with, 13 rather, with Vince Vaughn and Owen Wilson, it was I played the character of Mr. Chetty, and they wanted the character to have an Indian accent. And I went in, and I auditioned with an Indian accent, and one of the producers called me afterward, or called my manager, rather, afterwards, and said, we'd like him to come back and read again. We liked what he did. What we'd like to do is hire him a dialect coach. And my manager was like, you know, for what dialect? And they said Indian, and she was like, you know, he is Indian, right? And so it was this weird thing where, like, there was a conversation that we ended up having with one of the producers where I was like, they were like, you know, yes, we know that you're Indian and you do the accent, but the other people had much stronger accents than you did. And I was like, I'm sure they did, but it was sort of me. That always has happened in my career, or many times, where you do the accent, but you try to modulate it in such a way so that, like, you're not doing some kind of Apu type, you know, caricature. And I remember saying to the producer, I said, "Look, I'm not gonna sound like Apu. I'm going to sound like Fareed Zakaria. Is that okay?" And they were like, "Oh, that's great. That's great." We love Fareed Zakaria.
Exactly. You briefly touched on it before. I want to talk more about your one-man show and the success of Sakina's Restaurant, which was then adapted to the film Today's Special. And as you were saying, this was your way of kind of taking back that power of having these roles that were not caricatures, that these were real-life stories of South Asians. Sakina's Restaurant, if I remember, you based the characters on your own yourself and your own family. Is that correct?
Yeah. My family has often been the raw material, much to their chagrin, you know, that for my writing and my comedy and my, you know. So Sakina's Restaurant, I wanted to write characters that were, real, that were, you know, I was going in for all these characters. I remember saying one time to a casting director that I'm glad that they wrote an Indian character in this TV show, but it's a shame that they've never met an Indian person before, because we don't talk like this, you know. Yeah. And that was often the scenario. And so I wanted to write characters that were true from my perspective of real human beings. And so I started writing these characters, which ultimately became the show Sakina's Restaurant. And I used my family as sort of the basis for those characters, and then, you know, and like I've done, then I went on to do that in Today's Special as well, where Today's Special was the film that was inspired by Sakina's Restaurant, and I used, I wanted to tell a more nuanced, complex story about South Asian characters and the South Asian story, and then in the book even, you know, I've again taken my family as the raw material, and then so often extrapolated from that to tell a story that is about something larger, but using my family as sort of the starting point, you know?
Absolutely. And I wanted to talk more about, you've mentioned that you don't feel that you're any kind of expert on Islam. And I feel like outside of scholars, I don't think I was an expert on religions anyways. But
right.
And then you were cast as the senior Muslim correspondent on The Daily Show. But what's interesting is even prior to your tenure on The Daily Show, I remember seeing you in films like American Chai and ABCD and roles that are centered around the South Asian experience in
right.
the U.S. How did you come to terms with those kind of issues and not being an expert on Islam, but being cast as the senior Muslim correspondent in this new wave of roles that you take?
Right. Well, I mean, you know, luckily The Daily Show, everything on The Daily Show is ironic on some level, you know. So when I was cast as the senior Muslim correspondent, it was ironically the senior Muslim correspondent, although I don't think my parents realized that initially, and they thought, like, they were like, don't ever talk about Islam on The Daily Show because you know nothing about it, you know. But luckily, when I got on The Daily Show and I was the senior Middle East / Muslim / Brown, whatever, doctor, you know, correspondent, it became a way for me to kind of talk about things that I had not even realized that I wanted to talk about, and I started like reporting, quote unquote, you know, on stories from the Middle East and about things that were going on in the world relating to South Asians and being Muslim and being brown, and suddenly, like, I sort of started to feel like, oh, this was kind of important to me. I almost started to feel, I started to like it in a weird way, you know, and that was very disconcerting, because for so long wanted to reject that part of myself, and you know, even when I wrote Sakina's Restaurant, it was a way, you know, often writers write things to reveal aspects of themselves, and so it was a way for me to reveal myself, but I never actually wanted to be identified as Muslim in any way or whatever. And then suddenly here I was on this comedy show being identified as Muslim, and it was having an impact. Like, it was actually like not on like policy or whatever, but like was having an impact on like American Muslims in
it did
in
have an impact. You won an award for courage in media.
I did, yes.
So there was an impact, in fact.
Yeah, well, you know, and again, in the book, I talk about this, the idea that, like, I started getting these awards from, like, Muslim organizations, and I realized, like, this is crazy, because I'm just doing pratfalls and making funny faces and, you know, standing in front of a green screen. I'm not risking my life. I'm not actually going to Baghdad, you know? And so courage in media sort of felt ridiculous. Like, how much courage does it take to stand in front of a green screen, you know? But I realized, like, as I was getting some of these awards, that they were not giving the award. It was because there was such a lack of representation. There was such a vacuum of, like, people talking about this stuff and from this perspective of being South Asian, of being sort of a voice that was inside and outside the culture at the same time. There was such a vacuum and such a lack of that in the media, in the mainstream media, that people were just, like, super excited that there was this guy who was brown and he was, like, openly talking about American Muslims or the Middle East from the perspective of somebody who is not a white American reporter, you know? And so that, I think they were giving me the award because of what that represented to them, not so much about my own personal courage. At least that's how I ended up justifying it. Because honestly, it's the easiest thing to do in the world is stand in front of a green screen.
That's Asif Manvi, actor, writer, and producer, joining me by phone from New York. His book is No Land's Man, and it's on sale now. You can also see him on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart, and next year on HBO's The Brink. Asif Manvi, thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you.
Coming up tomorrow, the Northwest Film Center proudly presents the premiere screening of the 2014 iteration of Project Viewfinder, the culminating work of a mentorship program for homeless young adults. The film will be screened on Wednesday, December 10th at 5:30 p.m. in the Northwest Film Center's Witzel Auditorium, located outside the Portland Art Museum, 1219 Southwest Park Avenue. The evening will consist of short films made by the participants about the myths and realities of homelessness, along with interviews and footage of their experiences and struggles. After the film, there will be a reception for the young filmmakers. Admission is free to the public. That's it for Stage and Studio. Thanks so much to KABU engineer Janet Anderson. If you missed any of this show, visit stageandstudio.org. You can also download shows at iTunes. And don't forget to like us on facebook.com/stage_studio or tweet us at @stage_studio. The music you're hearing is Sri Lankan American blues artist B. Beeman. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. Up next is Art Focus with host Joseph Galavan. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market. Open daily December 17th through December 24th for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade art, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at Southwest Ankeny and Nato Parkway in Waterfront Park. Information at PortlandSaturdayMarket.com.
I'd like to be a gallery, put you all inside my show. Andy Warhol looks a scream.
My name's Joseph Galavan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Radio Portland. My guest this week is Julia Dolan. She's the Minor White Curator of Photography at the Portland Art Museum. She's here to talk about Blue Sky, the Oregon Center for the Photographic Arts at 40. Welcome to KBOO, Julia.
Thank you.
So everybody in Portland probably knows Blue Sky Gallery. It's been around 40 years. It used to be in a little house in the northwest area, and now it's got its swanky place on the North Park blocks.
It does. It has its own owned space now.
And so your museum is celebrating their existence with a big show. How many people have they shown over the years?
Blue Sky, in the past 39 going on 40 years, has shown over 650 artists in over 750